Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Dillanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newland, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, political analysts suggest that a decision on future logging along the northern coast range of Oregon will depend on who is the next governor.
America's death toll in Iraq for the month of October closed at 105, the worst tally in nearly 2 years.
Sudan's Minister of Culture said today in Geneva, quote, "We believe the security in Darfur is okay."
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,818 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 49,938 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A report released by The Lancet puts the number at more than 600,000 civilians dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 1st, 2006. 6 days until the 2006 midterm election. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. A decision on how much logging to allow in the vast state forests along the northern coast range may well depend on who is the next governor. Four of the seven members of the Oregon Board of Forestry are serving in expired terms. They could be replaced by whoever is elected governor next week. Ron Saxton, the Republican candidate for governor, says the primary role of state forests is to produce revenue. Democratic Governor Ted Kulongoski backs an existing state forest management plan and would not favor logging over other resource values. Both Kulongoski and Saxton said they would try to maintain a balance in their appointments to the Board of Forestry.
A city council candidate who disappeared a few months ago has been found and has taken a job as a TV reporter in eastern Montana. Emily Boyles owes the city of Portland $95,000 plus interest in public campaign funds. The city auditor says Emily Boyles violated the city's public financing code earlier this year by taking out a year's lease on her campaign headquarters. And she also paid her 16-year-old daughter $12,500 for internet marketing work. Boyles, who said has experience in public broadcasting and cable television, said she wanted to be left alone to do her work. And she also said, "If the people of Portland want to be repaid, please don't call me at work so I don't lose my job."
A former soldier convicted of sexually abusing an 8-year-old boy in 1995 has been sentenced to more than 14 years in prison. James Miller maintained his innocence at yesterday's sentencing. Until July, 29-year-old James Miller was an Army military officer with the rank of sergeant. He was back in the United States on leave from Iraq. The victim broke his silence about the abuse in June when he confided the secret after attempting suicide. In cooperation with Gresham Police, the victim phoned Miller. As the tape recorder rolled, Miller apologized for what he had done more than a decade ago. Miller, who was 17 in the summer of 1995, had made friends with the victim's father and was helping to coach the victim's Little League team in Gresham.
Some Republicans say that if Democrats take control of the U.S. House in next week's elections, Democratic leaders will spend the next 2 years attempting to impeach President Bush. Oregon's four Democratic House members, blindly groping in the dark for anything resembling their spines, say that that's simply not true. Republicans point to a bill introduced last year by Representative John Conyers of Michigan, the likely chair of the House Judiciary Committee if Democrats win control. The bill would create a committee to investigate the White House's decision to go to war and recommend whether there are grounds for impeachment. Representative David Wu is the only member of the Oregon delegation among the 37 co-sponsors of Conyers' bill. While he believes a thorough investigation is necessary, he said impeachment would be highly unlikely. Representative Darlene Hooley of Oregon said that while Democratic control would lead to greater oversight of the administration, impeachment isn't on the Democratic agenda.
U.S. Republican Senator Gordon Smith will host his fourth annual Oregon Tribal Summit at Kamawa Indian School in Salem. Smith will hold a roundtable discussion with Oregon tribal leaders and federal Indian Affairs officials. They will address a wide range of issues, including economic development, health care, and education. Smith is a member of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. The meeting begins at 2 p.m. and is expected to last till 3:30.
Two Portland activists, Mateo Bernal and Nico Thanos, were in court today. They were arrested last night after locking themselves to the doors of the Mexican embassy in downtown Portland. The pair were protesting the Mexican government's brutal crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in Oaxaca. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke this afternoon with Nikki Thanos after her court hearing.
Last night we expressed our dissatisfaction with
the continuing escalation of the Mexican government's military presence in Oaxaca, particularly their attacks against an unarmed civilian population and the deaths last week of five people, four Mexicans, and a U.S. journalist, and the over nine people who have been killed in Oaxaca since the teachers and the broad-based social movement in Oaxaca began their struggle about 6 months ago. We were charged with criminal mischief too. Mateo was, and I, what I'll be charged with is still pending, and I'll have my hearing in 2 weeks. We were under the understanding as of last night and even this morning that we were being charged with a felon charge. It appears that they're going to reduce that to a misdemeanor, but that's not certain, and that's still up to the prosecutors. So we don't have anything figured out yet, but yeah, I think that there will be some pending legal fees, and we'll let folks know how they can help us out.
That was activist Nikki Thanos. And if her voice sounded familiar to you, that's because you've heard her on the KBOO News already this year. She traveled throughout the Pacific Northwest performing the Drug War Roadshow. Keep with Nikki and Mateo Bernal's case at www.pcasc.net.
Behavioral and emotional problems in mentally disabled children do not decrease substantially as they become adults, according to a new study from Oregon State University researchers and Australian colleagues. The findings, which suggest a heightened need for mental health intervention, were published in the October 25th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. The study included almost 600 children and teens who were between the ages of 5 and 19 at the start of their research in 1991. They were judged by the Developmental Behavioral Checklist, a standard measure for children with developmental disabilities. As most previous findings have found, this study provides clear evidence that the problem of psychopathology coexisting with intellectual disability is both substantial and persistent.
A large and persistent dead zone of low oxygen water off Oregon's central coast that killed crab and other sea life has finally faded away thanks to shifting ocean winds, according to university researchers. The low oxygen conditions were of record intensity and encompassed a roughly 70-mile-long swath of water larger than Rhode Island just off the coast. These conditions lasted for about 4 months, far longer than any of the previous dead zones tracked off Oregon during the past 5 years, according to Oregon State University researchers who have monitored oxygen levels throughout the summer and fall. In August, scientists documented record low oxygen readings, which appeared to wipe out most bottom-dwelling sea life in one reef that the scientists explored with the aid of a remote-operated video camera.
The Oregon Shakespeare Festival wrapped up its 2006 season on Sunday at 87% of capacity, with a total attendance of nearly 400,000 and ticket revenues exceeding $14 million. Attendance was the second highest in OSF's history after 2002, which saw a total attendance almost as high as this year. The 2006 figures are up approximately 2% from 2005. OSF attributes the season's success to its diverse playbill, the impact of online ticketing, web-related marketing, a committed membership, and strong group sales.
An Issaquah, Washington school bus driver who was fired for flipping off President Bush is trying to get her job back. The driver has filed a union grievance against the district, claiming wrongful termination. Last June, the president's limo passed by several school buses in Issaquah. The students waved to the president, and Bush waved back. He seemed to be having a good time until he saw the driver flipping him off. A complaint was called into the school district, and the driver was fired in September. A spokeswoman for the district says the gesture was not at all appropriate modeling for students on the bus.
The only nuclear power plant in Washington State was automatically shut down yesterday when monitoring equipment indicated a problem with the system that controls steam to the main turbine. Energy Northwest expects the Columbia Generating Station at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation to be offline for several days while the safety system is checked. Workers are using the opportunity for routine maintenance. The plant generates power worth about $1 million a day. It had operated for a record 486 days straight. The next scheduled shutdown is in May for refueling.
And now, time for another edition of KBOO's homegrown environmental series, Our Backyard, produced and hosted by our good friend, Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, just 1 week before the midterm elections, the Bush administration continues its shameless assault on our backyard. Monday, a newly appointed administrator to the EPA Region 10 with a background in the chemical and pesticide industry was greeted by protests as she arrived in Seattle to take over her job. Region 10 is responsible for Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. Also, environmental groups from across the Northwest are protesting cutbacks and changes taking place in the Environmental Protection Agency's Regional Office of Civil Rights and Environmental Justice. Programs administered by that office help ensure fair treatment for people who are often most affected by pollution, namely low-income residents and minorities. The office responsible for Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska was already the smallest of the EPA's 10 regional offices. And now, this appointment and this so-called reorganization of the Office of Civil Rights and Environmental Justice illustrate perfectly the Bushites' idea of how government should work. Ellen Miller, the new Region 10 administrator, comes to the EPA after a successful career as president and CEO of Arista Life Science North America and Austral Asia, an agricultural chemical pesticide company. Before that, she held various high-level executive positions at Dow Chemical from 1996 to 2004. Jerry Sundvall Williams, executive director of the Environmental Justice Action Group, in a joint news release from activist groups, said, "The EPA has a responsibility to protect the community, and an appointment like this reflects their unwillingness to do so. It's an example of the fox guarding the hen house," she said. Environmentalists are also concerned about closing the Office of Civil Rights and Environmental Justice for Region 10. Offices dedicated to environmental justice got their genesis in the Clinton era when an executive order mandated that federal agencies review the effects of their programs on low-income and minority communities. However, a report put out by the EPA's own Office of the Inspector General last month determined that EPA senior management has not sufficiently directed program and regional offices to conduct environmental justice reviews. That office handled such issues as cleanup of an industrial site in poor neighborhoods where residents are concerned about exposure. The three staff members working for EPA's Regional Office of Civil Rights and Environmental Justice are now being moved to different departments within EPA, and two of the officials will be scaling back the time they devote to this type of work. EPA officials say the office closure was forced by budget cuts. The four-state region has lost 17 staff positions to budget cuts since 2001, and another 12 positions are expected to be cut in fiscal year 2007. Activists say the EPA's Environmental Justice Office in the Northwest has helped them through the agency's bureaucratic maze, providing pamphlets and equipment to communicate with Spanish speakers and advocated for the interests of the poor and minorities during decisions by the agency. But these same environmentalists say that the office has now effectively been gut shot, and they worry it's a preview of the priorities of the region's new administrator, Ellen Miller. Especially worrying are Ms. Miller's past generous contributions to political action committees and elected officials whose commitment to the environment isn't suspect at all. We know how these guys feel about the planet. They don't. Her support of the Crop Life America Political Action Committee and her support for California Congressman Jerry Lewis and Richard Pombo, arguably two of the most prominent environmental enemies in the nation, doesn't bode well for the region. Ms. Miller's appointment and the reorganization of the Region 10 EPA office only deepens suspicions that EPA actions are increasingly governed by business interests rather than protecting the nation's most vulnerable residents from pollution. Activists, including the Environmental Justice Action Group based in Portland, and others representing 11 different groups have asked to meet with EPA officials to discuss these changes. The Bush administration's consistent appointment of industry-friendly administrators to important positions like EPA Region 10 is further evidence of their belief that the environment is nothing more than a treasure trove of resources that exists solely to enrich them and their supporters. This uncaring and money-focused reality celebrated by the Bushites has already caused incredible harm to virtually every element of our environment. It must be halted. Remember that when you vote. And in the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
The current time is 5:14. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News. year, a new spicy spin on how arthritis may be eased. A new classified military chart portrays Iraq as edging toward chaos, according to the New York Times. And hear which American candidate is promising to blindside firefighters rushing to save cats caught in trees. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
This year's midterm election, now less than 1 week away, will be subject to the most changes in voting machines and election laws yet. Leaders from several civil liberties groups say they're on the watch for dirty tricks and that are being used to deceive or intimidate voters. Jan Mejia has more in Washington, D.C.
About 2 weeks ago in Orange County, California, thousands of registered voters with Latino surnames received a letter claiming that immigrants who vote in federal elections could be jailed. Republican candidate Tan Nguyen, running for the U.S. House of Representatives, acknowledged that his campaign's office manager participated in sending out these letters, although he denied having anything to do with it personally. The California Attorney General is investigating Nguyen's role in this scheme. Jonah Goldman directs the National Campaign for Fair Elections at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He says, actions intended to discourage people from voting tend to happen closer to election day.
They usually don't happen until right on the eve of elections because they're done in such a sort of clandestine fly-by-night sort of way, so it makes it really difficult to track who's doing them and why and when they're doing them.
In order to correct deceptive information and protect voters, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the People for the American Way Foundation, and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law have formed a voter protection coalition and opened up a voter assistant hotline.
Thank you for calling the Election Protection Hotline, 1-866-OUR-VOTE.
On the phone, trained volunteers answer voters' questions and address their concerns. In 2004, the Election Protection Hotline, run by the same coalition, received numerous complaints from voters. Some voters in Florida reported individuals who claimed to be from the Kerry campaign went door-to-door telling voters to vote on absentee ballots they handed out, and later took those ballots away. They instructed voters not to go to the polls. In Wisconsin, voters complained they received flyers saying if you already voted in any election this year, you cannot vote in the presidential election. Similar incidences were reported in Ohio, Illinois, and Arizona. Hillary Shelton is the director of NAACP's Washington, D.C. Bureau. He says those who would defraud voters are more likely to target people of color, senior citizens, and voters in low-income communities with deceptive information.
These are folks that are less likely in their minds to be well-informed and well-educated, and then the assumption is that they can mislead them and drive them away from the polls one way or another.
In order to ensure that every vote will count, the NAACP will dispatch volunteers to monitor poll stations, and it will focus on 10 states where ballot problems and incidences of voter intimidation were reported in previous elections. Goldman says civil rights groups have to initiate these voter protection programs because the government is not doing a sufficient job.
There's what there should be, and what some legislators have actually proposed, is a process by which it would be the government's responsibility to provide correct information in places where there's evidence that this type of misinformation is going on.
But sometimes the government misinforms voters too. Early this month, a week after a judge struck down a Georgia law requiring voters to show photo IDs at polls, the State Board of Elections sent out thousands of letters to voters telling them they have to provide photo IDs before they vote. The board later sent another round of letters saying that IDs are not required. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg News reported today that Diebold Incorporated is demanding that HBO cancel a documentary that criticizes its voting machines. Diebold is alleging the program is, quote, inaccurate and unfair. The show called Hacking Democracy airs tomorrow. The film features activists showing that Diebold voting machines are not tamper-proof and can be manipulated to change voting results. Diebold officials sent a letter to HBO Monday demanding that letter asks for disclaimers to be aired and for HBO to post Diebold's response on its website. According to Diebold officials, inaccuracies in the film include the assertion that Diebold tabulated more than 40% of the votes cast in the 2000 presidential election. The letter says Diebold was not in the electronic voting business in 2000 when disputes over ballots in Florida delayed President Bush's victory for more than a month and raised questions about the reliability of electronic voting machines.
The death toll for Americans in Iraq now stands at 105 for October, according to the military, and violence there today killed at least 27 more Iraqis. Police are searching for at least 40 Shiites abducted along a dangerous highway north of Baghdad, and there's no word yet on the fate of two coaches kidnapped from a Baghdad youth club. Police say the victims were grabbed by a group of men in SUVs and taken away today. One was the head of Iraq's National Basketball Federation, who coached the country's team, and the other was a coach for blind athletes.
Democratic Senator John Kerry apologized for a botched joke about the Iraq War that President George W. Bush and other Republicans condemned as insulting to U.S. troops. The heated exchange injected last-minute fireworks into a tight race between Republicans trying to cling to control of Congress in the November 7th elections and Democrats striving to win it back. Kerry said he meant no offense to troops when he told a college audience on Monday that young people might get stuck in Iraq if they do not make it through the educational system. He said, quote, "You cannot get into the military today if you do badly in school." But he also said the White House was purposely twisting his words and asserted that it is Bush who owes troops an apology for a misguided war in Iraq.
A Republican legislator in Florida has resigned after admitting that he sent profane and racist messages to a fellow state lawmaker. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
South Florida House member Ralph Arza resigned today shortly after it was reported that prosecutors will charge the Republican and his cousin with felony counts of tampering with and retaliating against a witness. The charges and the resignation come from phone calls that Arza and his cousin made 10 days ago to State Representative Gus Barrero. Arza had used a racial slur on the call. Barrero had just filed a House rules complaint against Arza, alleging that the lawmaker had twice used racial slurs to describe Miami-Dade County's black schools chief, Rudy Crew. Shortly after Arza left a second message to Barrero, his cousin, Paulino Barbone, allegedly called and was far more explicit, saying, among other things, that he and Arza would, quote, crack your head open. Had he not left office, Arza would likely have been expelled from the Florida House by a two-thirds vote when it convenes in its first post-election session later this month. Governor Jeb Bush and numerous other fellow Republicans had already asked him to resign. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Hundreds of Texans marched in their state capital this past weekend to call attention to three death row prisoners who were executed and later found to be innocent. The issue of innocence has changed the death penalty debate more than any other issue. Renee Feltz has the story.
Polls show many Americans' views on capital punishment have been shaped by reports of exonerated prisoners who walked off death row and into the free world. These images play a key role in the recent decline in support for executions. And in a recent Gallup poll, over 70% thought innocent people have already been executed, most likely in Texas. And that was the clear message on Saturday. Texas executes innocent people. Jim Combs is president of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
We know now that Carlos de Luna, Ruben Cantu, and Todd Willingham were poisoned by the people of Texas and in the name of the people of Texas, and they were innocent. This system is broken.
A recent three-part series in the Chicago Tribune examined the case of Texas death row prisoner Carlos de Luna. It outlined how he was convicted in a case of mistaken identity. He was executed in 1989. His sister, Mary Hernando, spoke Saturday.
He went to the very end from the beginning saying he didn't do it, that Carlos Hernandez had done it. But nobody believed him. Nobody cared to, you know, take the initiative to follow what he told them.
In 2004, Texas's execution of Todd Willingham was exposed as another case of an innocent man being put to death. just months after his execution for setting fire to a house in which his three children burned to death, it was discovered the fire was in fact an accident. Several of his family members drove from Oklahoma for Saturday's protest, including his mother, Eugenia.
I'm really disappointed in the whole system. I thought all along, I just knew he would get a stay. And when he didn't, I cannot put in words how disappointed and how hurt and how sick, and I still am.
Willingham may testify before the state Congress next year. Given the poor performance of public defenders, she joins protester Stephanie Collins in supporting the creation of an independent innocence commission
that can hear these kind of claims of actual innocence before it's too late, before somebody's been executed.
Other states, like Florida, are considering the creation of two independent commissions. The first would establish the cause of wrongful convictions in capital cases and recommend changes to prevent future wrongful convictions. The second commission would review claims of innocence from those on death row. So far, concerns that states are executing innocent people hasn't translated into death penalty abolition or a moratorium. But for protesters like Alicia from Houston, that's clearly a long-term goal.
And I think if Texas overturns the death penalty, other states are going to fall behind and do it. I really believe that.
In Austin, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
80 parents, grandparents, and children demonstrated Monday outside a political fundraiser attended by House Speaker Dennett Hastert to push Congress toward passing the Combating Autism Act. The bill, which was approved by the Senate in August, would set up a strategic plan for addressing autism and allocate $900 million for fighting the disorder, demonstrators said. Supporters of the bill say Representative Joe Barton, a Texas Republican who is chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, has let the bill languish in a subcommittee and kept it from being considered by the rest of the House. At least one of every 166 school-aged children suffer from autism, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates. Boys are 3 to 4 times more likely to have the disease than girls.
An industrial products company in Ohio is fed up with all the traffic on its website from people who really want YouTube. Universal Tube and Rollform Equipment in Perrysburg, Ohio, has filed a lawsuit against the San Bruno-based online video portal. Universal Tube's web address is the letter U, then tube.com. The lawsuit demands that YOUtube.com either change its name or pay so the manufacturer can create a new web domain and corporate identity. Universal Tube executives say its site is now jammed with more than 100 times the traffic it used to get. The company's owner says they've even heard from Australian authorities accusing Universal Tube of having child pornography on its website.
The Supreme Court heard a case on emission standards for coal power plants today. The case, Duke Energy versus the Environmental Protection Agency, could impact how old plants comply with new environmental regulations. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Environmental regulations have forced coal plants to be cleaner. Coal-fired power plants are central to the United States' energy needs. But coal power plants are some of the dirtiest polluters, as many of them are at least 50 years old. But the future of coal looks bright. It's expected to make up 50% of the new energy by 2030, according to the Department of Energy. Environmental regulations, old coal plants, and their future brings us to today's Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court could rule to clarify the Environmental Protection Agency's interpretation of the Clean Air Act. The respondent, Duke Energy, has 50-year-old coal power plants in North and South Carolina. In the 1980s, Duke Energy refurbished the plant's deteriorating infrastructure, but failed to obtain new environmental permits from the Environmental Protection Agency to update their emission standards. The reason is because their pollution output was to stay the same. Nearly 20 years later, in 2000, the EPA said Duke's power plants violated portions of the Clean Air Act. Carter Phillip argued the case for Duke Energy. He says the EPA can't retroactively change their interpretation of the statute.
When we did ask the regulators what to do, every one of these projects was inspected by a North Carolina or a South Carolina inspector. Every one of them was determined not to be subject to this statute. And that's why we're saying, look, you can't come back 20 years later and say it's a do-over and you owe us billions of dollars. That's just wrong.
Duke Energy argued that they were compliant because their emissions rate per hour was going to stay the same. But the EPA and environmental groups argue that Congress didn't care about the hourly rate of emissions, but the total amount of pollutants emitted throughout the year. Duke's annual emissions increased because they would be able to operate their plants 24 hours a day instead of 12 because of their new refurbishments. Sean Donahue with Environmental Defense, attorney for the petitioner.
The regulatory problem here is that in 1977, Congress did grandfather existing plants to a degree. And partly that's because it costs more to retrofit than to install control equipment in a new plant. The problem here is that Duke's position is that this was a permanent grandfathering of capacity, so that as long as you don't exceed the capacity that you had when the plant was built in 1942, as is the case in the earliest one in this case, you can continually kind of keep it going without pollution controls under this program.
The outcome of this case could determine that three dozen other existing coal-fired power plants could be violating air quality standards. The state of Alabama has sided with Duke Energy. They have half a dozen coal plants that could be affected by this decision. But on the other side of the argument, supporting the environmentalists and the EPA are the states of New Jersey and New York, who fear the consequences of coal pollution. John Balbus is a physician and director of the public health program at Environmental Defense.
The real reason that we're here is to be protecting the hearts and the lungs of the Americans living downwind of these highly polluting, aging power plants and other similar industrial facilities. It's really about reducing the burden of death and disease that this nation is experiencing now, in part from these aging, highly polluting power plants.
But Duke Energy says they are leading the way in clean technology, surpassing state and federal regulations and helping to implement the Clean Smokestacks Act. Duke's first clean smokestack went online Monday. Mark Manley is Duke's general counsel.
The GNP growth over a period of time is up 195%. Population is up. Autos are up. But emissions are down 54%. And that's without the government having won this case.
The Supreme Court could rule in a variety of ways. They could clarify the interpretation of the Clean Air Act, or they could rule that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction to decide this case. The Clean Air Act states that only the D.C. Circuit Court can adjudicate their law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
eSolve, the National Infertility Association, has received the 2006 Angel in Adoption Award for contributions toward the welfare of children in the United States foster care system and orphans around the world. Resolve was nominated by Connecticut Congresswoman Nancy Johnson for recognition of its adoption programs held in cities and towns across the country. The Angels in Adoption program, created by the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute, is their signature public awareness program. It honors the good work of constituents who have enriched the lives of foster children and orphans in the United States and internationally. Each year, more than 160 members of Congress participate, making it the year's single most significant congressional event pertaining to child welfare in the United States.
New research shows that turmeric, a spice used in curries, may curb arthritis joint inflammation. So say scientists, including Dr. Janet Funk of the Arizona Health Sciences Center at the University of Arizona. Turmeric has been used for centuries in traditional Indian Ayurvedic medicine to treat inflammation. Though turmeric shows promise and deserves further study, it may be too soon to move it from your spice rack to the bathroom medicine cabinet. The study appears in Arthritis and Rheumatism's November edition.
The breakthrough is being hailed as a vital step towards creating a fully artificial liver that can be used for transplants within as little as 10 years from now. A team from Newcastle University in England grew a tiny liver, believed to be the first of its kind in the world, using stem cells from umbilical cords. The miniature livers can now be used for drug and pharmaceutical testing, eradicating the need to test on animals and humans.
The current time is 5:33. Now another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In George W.'s glorious new People's Democracy of Iraq, journalists don't strive to win a Pulitzer Prize. They strive to stay out of jail and stay alive. In Iraq, reporting what you see and hear, which after all is what a reporter does, gives you an awfully good chance of getting not a prize, but a bullet in the head. Since the Bush occupation began, more than 130 Iraqi reporters have gone to their final reward, violently. Now, however, a new job hazard confronts journalists, jail. Iraq's new leaders, while purporting to be governing a budding democracy, have not quite grasped the fundamental democratic concept of freedom of expression, instead revealing themselves to be remarkably touchy despots. The parliament has enacted a sweeping set of laws to criminalize criticism of, well, of themselves and of other government officials. In the past year, about a dozen journalists have been charged with, quote, offending public officials. Three reporters, for example, are standing trial in Baghdad for violating Section 226 of the Iraqi Penal Code, which outlaws public insults to the government or its officials, punishable by up to 7 years in prison. The crime of these three is that they wrote articles about the governor, some local judges, and police officials engaged in corruption. In an ironic twist, some of these new repressive laws were lifted verbatim from the penal code of old Saddam Hussein. Saddam would also smile on the repressive move of Prime Minister Maliki, who has compelled some 70 Iraqi news organizations to sign a 9-point pledge not to report in ways that the government considers inflammatory, and to disseminate news in a way that, quote, harmonizes with the government's goals. This is Jim Hightower saying, something tells me that George W. himself would really like to import some of this Iraqi-style democracy back to the U.S.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Circle A Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. At 7, it's Nonstop Hip Hop with DJ Audio. The weather is getting rainy. Showers expected tomorrow in the Willamette Valley. Freezing rain expected in the Columbia Gorge with a high of 55 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A classified briefing prepared 2 weeks ago by the U.S. Central Command portrays Iraq as sliding toward chaos in a chart that the military is using as a barometer of civil conflict, the New York Times reported today. A one-page slide shown at the October 18th briefing provides a rare glimpse into how the military command that oversees the war is trying to track its trajectory, particularly in terms of sectarian fighting. The slide includes a color-coded bar chart that is used to illustrate an index of civil conflict. It shows a sharp escalation in sectarian violence since the bombing of a Shiite shrine in Samarra in February, and tracks a further worsening this month despite a concerted American push to tamp down the violence in Baghdad. An intelligence summary at the bottom of the slide reads, urban areas experiencing ethnic cleansing campaigns to consolidate control, and violence at all-time high spreading geographically.
At least 23 Iraqis, including 9 children, were killed Wednesday when a suicide bomber attacked a wedding party. 2 U.S. soldiers were killed, raising the number of U.S. military personnel casualties to 105, making October the deadliest month for U.S. military since the start of the war. Meanwhile, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has ordered a stop to the week-long blockade on Sadr City. FSRN Salam Talib has the story.
A car bomb exploded in Sadr City Sunday, killing about 28 people that were gathering to find work. For a week, Sadr City has been blocked by U.S. and Iraqi military. But this did not stop the attacks. Professor Mazen Al-Samurai says that there is a political war happening in Iraq, and the parties are putting pressure on each other by using car bombs.
Car bombs were used to target the U.S. military. Now it is a political tool to target the Iraqis. We observe that there are two kinds of car bombs, the car bombs with a suicide bomber and the other kind, which is just a parked car on the street, which will explode. This kind of car bomb is a political tool that some political parties use to express their opinions.
Sadr City has been under siege since an American Iraqi soldier went missing. The U.S. military claims that the soldier is being held in Sadr City. Fadal Al-Chara lives in Sadr City.
Karada is too far. It is about 10 miles northwest of Sadr City. The U.S. military laid siege on Karada and Sadr City at the same time, claiming that the missing soldier is in the city. They searched some houses and they found nothing. Then they stayed in Sadr City for the last week. Now the people are not going to work regularly. In order to go to the other neighborhoods from Sadr City, you have to make the trip in 3 or 4 stages. That makes people tired of the situation. It is a really bad situation.
The Al-Sadr movement has called teachers and government employees to strike and shut down the city.
The people were forced to strike by the militia, and this made the people's lives even more difficult. My kids have been turned away from school because the militia did not allow the teachers to work. People are the victims in the end, and their life is the price.
In reaction to the strike, Prime Minister al-Maliki ordered the Iraqi and the American troops to stop the blockage and open Sadr City again.
Sadr City is not the only city under siege. Many cities in Iraq are under siege. For example, Anbar has been under siege for more than 4 months. The government should react the same way toward every city and not be selective about which city they will support. The government represents all Iraqis and not a chosen sect.
The resident of Sadr City celebrated at the city streets, cheering for al-Maliki for taking an independent decision. And they are hoping that the government takes more power and will be able to fix the security situation in Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Salam Talib.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair survived a close vote on Iraq in the House of Commons last night, but suffered the humiliation of seeing as many as 24 of his own parliamentary allies not supporting his position. While a dozen Labour backbenchers abstained, another dozen voted with the opposition on a cross-party motion demanding an inquiry into the Iraq invasion and its aftermath. Initially, nearly 50 Labour members of Parliament had reportedly indicated that they would support the motion. But many changed their minds after they were warned that a defeat could trigger calls for the government to resign.
UN officials yesterday warned that aid workers' precarious access to needy people in Darfur could worsen. Violence has spiraled recently in Darfur, where more than 3 years of fighting have left more than 200,000 people dead and 2.5 million homeless. Fresh fighting has caused increasing numbers of aid workers to withdraw, leaving many refugees without food or medicine. The situation is extremely difficult for aid workers and is preventing them from accessing people, according to Simon Plous, a spokesman for the UN World Food Programme. He added aid workers were unable to gain access to some 224,000 people in Darfur during September. Plous said aid workers and the local population were constantly exposed to banditry and other criminal acts.
While the UN and much of the international community believes Darfur is spiraling into deeper chaos, Sudanese Culture Minister Mohamed Yusuf Abdullah held a news conference to say that the humanitarian situation was not that bad. He said 14 of Darfur's 23 provinces are now peaceful, with the south and west calmer than the north, adding, quote, "We believe the security in Darfur is okay," close quote. Abdullah, who was in Geneva to attend a cultural week organized by the Sudanese government, visited the United Nations European headquarters to talk to reporters. He conceded that it would be a problem if people were being driven from their homes, but he said that the main indicators of well-being, namely mortality and malnutrition rates, as well as the amount of clean water provided to the population, show that the situation is just fine. Naturally, these indicators do not take into account sexual violence against women and children, the minister said when asked about widespread reports of rapes of civilians.
Hezbollah's leader has confirmed indirect talks with Israel over prisoner exchange. Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah said the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, had appointed a mediator to work with both sides. Hezbollah captured 2 Israeli soldiers in a cross-border raid in July, sparking 34 days of fighting in Lebanon. The group has offered to exchange the soldiers for Arab prisoners in Israel, but Israel has repeatedly refused.
A senior Pakistani journalist was murdered in Islamabad last night. FSRN correspondent Mazroor Hussain has the story.
The progressive editor of Pakistan Press International, Muhammad Ismail, was murdered under mysterious circumstances. Hospital sources say he was hit on the head with a blunt weapon which smashed his skull. The 53-year-old journalist had sent his family away and was living in the office. Colleagues say last night he returned from an embassy reception and went out for a routine walk but never came back. His dead body was discovered in the morning. Ismail was known as a friendly person and apparently had no property or family dispute. Pakistan Federal Union of Journalists has condemned the murder. A police investigation source said it is working on various leads. He said Ismail's murder was so horrific that it looks like the killers wanted to terrorize the Pakistani journalist community into submission. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
Rice traders and environmentalists have issued a stark warning to the Indian government at a meeting in Delhi. They say that trials of genetically modified or GM rice may harm exports and jeopardize the livelihoods of millions of poor farmers. The campaigners say they are concerned that commercial rice crops could become contaminated by GM strains, which will affect overseas sales. That could lead to restrictions on Indian crops abroad. India is one of the world's largest exporters of the long-grained aromatic basmati rice. Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, and other chemical giants have been experimenting with GM crops in India since at least 2005 or possibly longer. The government allowed the trials to go ahead despite protests over other GM foods. Last month, however, the Supreme Court suspended fresh tests on all crops pending a further court hearing. This from the BBC.
An international team of conservationists has released a report on the Niger Delta, listing it as one of the most polluted spots in the world. Environmentalists say 1.5 million tons of crude oil has spilled into the delta over the last 50 years. They also say local communities have suffered the environmental and social costs of development. The cost of the leaking oil is estimated at $10 million a day.
The city of Bangalore, India's technology center, is to be renamed Bengaluru. The decision to change the name was in response to a demand from local language activists. They say the name Bengaluru is closer to Benda Kaluru, the city's name before British colonization. More than 20 Indian cities have been renamed since India gained independence from Britain in 1947.
The death toll from floods in southeastern Ethiopia's Ogaden region has risen to 67. Almost 300,000 people have been affected after the Wabeshabele River burst its banks. Flooding typically occurs in Ethiopia's lowlands after the heavy rain season in June to September. This year's flooding has been especially damaging because it follows a period of severe droughts.
The situation on the ground in Oaxaca, Mexico, remains tense as federal forces begin to patrol neighborhood streets in pickups, truck convoys, and take over positions held by citizens, calling for the governor's removal. At deadline, neighborhood residents and teachers had been forced from the facilities of the state-run television and radio facilities. The death toll stands at 9, and many demonstrators are still missing and believed to be in police custody. An eyewitness on the scene said that a shock group affiliated with the ruling PRI party has begun to loot the equipment and as federal police looked on. Meanwhile, representatives of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca said they will not negotiate with the Interior Secretary so long as federal troops occupy the state capital and arbitrary detentions continue.
Election monitors from the Organization of American States told Washington not to meddle in Nicaragua's presidential election. Polls indicate Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega could likely win. As Dan McCurdy reports, this is the second time in a month that the OAS has condemned U.S. intervention in the Nicaraguan elections.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Gutierrez spoke of the historic danger represented by a possible Sandinista Party victory. He also said that $220 million in aid, the CAFTA agreement, and $270 million in private investment would be put at risk should Daniel Ortega be elected president on November 5th.
You know, for once, the Organization of American States has been very active in the situation. Previously, they were always rubber-stamped whatever U.S. position was.
Tom Loudon, co-director of the Quixote Center in Washington, D.C., a social justice service agency, recently returned from leading a U.S. election monitoring delegation.
Under the guise of democracy, the U.S. has been very actively supporting one candidate and denouncing another candidate, trying to interfere dramatically in the process and in the people's will to decide, an ability to decide who they want to be their president.
On September 25th, the OAS issued its first statement lamenting foreign intervention in the electoral debate in reference to a visit by the Republican congressman from Indiana, Dan Burton, who said in a press conference on September 24th that a Sandinista victory would mean war, inflation, and destabilization of the region. Dr. Vilma Nunez, who was a political prisoner under the Somoza dictatorship, as well as the first woman named to the Supreme Court, says the U.S. has been running a fear campaign in the Nicaraguan elections.
Everyone should remember that in the 80s, they didn't let Nicaragua develop a revolutionary process that promised important changes, and this was thwarted. Never before as now in these current elections has the level of interference and lack of respect with which the interference is carried out has totally gone over and above the limits of normal behavior that an ambassador should have.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua Oliver Garza visited in August 2005 to try to unite the right-wing parties. In March, former U.S. diplomat in the Reagan administration, Jean Kirkpatrick, visited with various right-wing parties. The head of the Resistance Party told the media that Kirkpatrick had told them that they should back ALN candidate Eduardo Montealegre. On October 11th, Kirkpatrick held a $500-a-head fundraiser for Montealegre in Arlington, Virginia. The U.S. ambassador in Nicaragua, Paul Trevelli, has intervened so permanently in the electoral process that over 1,000 U.S. citizens signed a letter to him that was placed in both Nicaraguan papers stating their opposition to U.S. threats and interference in the Nicaraguan electoral process. The Nicaraguan network has been keeping tabs on U.S. intervention in the electoral process since 2004. Catherine Hoyt is the co-coordinator of the network.
Every statement that our ambassador makes violates these, what are called the Vienna Conventions, that evidently lay out the role of diplomats in the countries to which they're assigned, and he goes outside the boundaries of that every week.
Bayardo Isava, executive director of the Nicaraguan Center for Human Rights, was in Congress in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday to denounce U.S. intervention.
As a human rights organization, we definitively reject this interventionism, and we call on the government of the United States and its functionaries to respect the will of the Nicaraguan citizens, who are the ones, in the end, that should decide without any type of threats or any type of coercion.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurry.
UK and U.S. forces have continued to use depleted uranium weapons despite warnings they pose a cancer risk, a BBC investigation has found. Scientists have pointed to health statistics in Iraq, where the weapons were used in the 1991 and 2003 wars. A report by the World Health Organization in 2001 said they posed only a small contamination risk. But a senior UN scientist said research showing how depleted uranium could cause cancer was withheld. The UK Ministry of Defense said that there was no evidence linking depleted uranium use to ill health. Depleted uranium is extremely dense and hard and is used for armor-piercing bullets or shells. Dr. Mike Repicoli, who oversaw work on the report, told the BBC that depleted uranium was basically safe. But Dr. Keith Beaverstock, who worked on the project, said research conducted by the U.S. Department of Defense suggested otherwise. Beaverstock's research was not included in the WHO report, and he believes it was blocked. Repicoli said the findings were not confirmed by other reports, and it was not WHO policy to publish speculative data. He denied any pressure was brought to bear. But other senior scientists have pointed to worrying health statistics in Iraq, which show a rise of cancer and birth defects. This from the BBC.
China has approved a law which will allow only the country's top court to approve death sentences. The move follows a series of miscarriages of justice since the 1980s when the lower courts were given powers to approve the death sentence themselves. The change in law takes effect on January 1st. Human rights groups say that China carries out more executions than any other country.
A revolutionary new sticking plaster skin cancer treatment, which is less painful and can be used by patients in their homes, has been developed by Scottish researchers. It is also believed that the technology could be used for anti-aging treatments. The incidence of skin cancer is growing rapidly and will affect 10% of Scots, around 500,000 of the current population in their lifetime. Existing treatments can involve surgical removal of the lesion, causing scarring and the risk of infection. The team spent 4 years to combine their expertise in photophysics and photodynamic therapy and create a new way of treating skin cancer. The result is a light bandage, which is powered by a pocket-sized battery and is so portable patients can go about their daily business while under treatment.
Delegates from trade unions worldwide launched a new Global Labor Federation today. The organization is aimed at ensuring that workers' rights are not forgotten in the rush toward economic globalization. Organizers said the International Trade Union Confederation would better tackle challenges to the rights of unionized workers and strengthen its efforts to stamp out forced and child labor. Officials said the new umbrella group, touted as the world's largest dedicated to workers' rights, would represent more than 150 million members from 241 affiliated organizations in 156 countries. It replaces the Brussels, Belgium-based International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, which was founded in 1949, to work on the enforcement of international labor standards.
More U.S. blacks attempt suicide than previously thought, according to a landmark study that could help explode the myth that black suicides are rare because of a mindset that took hold during slavery. The first nationally representative study to look at attempted suicide among blacks found that about 70,000 of them tried to kill themselves each year, and 4%, or roughly 1.4 million, attempt suicide at least once in their lives. That lifetime rate is similar to that of whites, but higher than the 2.8% found among blacks in previous surveys. Still, there is a common misperception that suicide is rare in the black community because of cultural and religious beliefs dating back to slavery times. The study strengthens evidence showing that belief is false, said University of Michigan researcher Sean Joe, the study's lead author. The findings appear in Wednesday's Journal of the American Medical Association.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies launched an appeal today to massively expand its anti-AIDS program in Southern Africa over the next 5 years. The Federation is appealing for $300 million to implement the expansion of its AIDS program in the region. With just a small fraction of more than 12 million HIV-positive people in Southern Africa currently receiving prevention, care, and treatment services, the time for idly standing by and watching the pandemic exact its deadly toll was over, said the Federation. The Red Cross estimates that 1 million people a year die of AIDS-related illnesses in the region, and that the number of orphans and vulnerable children is now 4.6 million and climbing.
The organization that oversees global internet functions warned today that a mistake in creating more web addresses using non-Latin letters could, quote, permanently break the internet. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, made the warning at a UN-organized conference on the future of the internet. Websites and addresses in languages besides English are becoming increasingly important as internet usage grows in developing countries where the Latin alphabet is often unfamiliar. Many believe ICANN should move faster in creating non-English domain name suffixes. Unwilling to wait, China has already set up its own .com in Chinese within its borders, while an Arabic consortium is testing suffixes in Arabic. Observers warn that fragmentation of the internet, possibly through countries adopting separate language-based systems, would destroy the web's basic usefulness. If that happens, people in China and the United States might reach entirely different websites if they type in the same address, or a browser might not recognize the address at all.
Most politicians like to play it safe, but not Tim Newkirk. He'll blindside firefighters rushing to save cats caught in a tree. He won't climb into bed with special interests, but he will with your sister. And he goes after a breed of criminal that most politicians prefer to ignore, the Hamburglar. Folks, I am not making this up. Mr. Newkirk is the star of a series of over-the-top campaign ads promoting his write-in campaign for Illinois governor. In one ad, the ominous narrator warns that some politicians are in bed with big business, casinos, or even organized crime. Then the camera shows a grinning Newkirk under the covers with a pretty young woman. And it says, "But Tim Newkirk, he's in bed with your sister." Again, I am not making this up. His campaign proposals include selling ad space on classroom ceilings so advertisers can reach daydreaming students, and drilling for oil in state parks. If you want more information on Mr. Newkirk's campaign, I'm sure you can use the Google to find it on the internets.
That's the KBOO Evening News for November 1st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203.
You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kwoo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer is, we don't have one. Our wire editor is Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Brianna Loringer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Afif Ahmed Shafi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. She'll present a discussion of race in America. Her guests will be two regular listeners to the show, LJ and Jeff Cook. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Per Fuggering interviews Ray Hyman, professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Oregon and the author of four books, including The Elusive Quarry, a scientific appraisal of psychic research. At 10, it's The Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter. She'll speak with members of the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association about alternatives to the gas guzzler. At 10:30, Julie Bernard's guest on Art Focus is choreographer Linda K. Johnson, who will talk about the Caldera Youth Programs. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. One final note, KBOO News is looking for more reporters to help us on election night, that's next Tuesday, especially in Southern Washington. Help us out by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203, and thanks for joining us.
It is 6:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and after this next announcement, it will be Circle A and talking about James Chassie.
Tune in Tuesday night, November 7th, for KBOO's live election night coverage. Our news and talk radio crew will be reporting live with candidate interviews, analysis, and up-to-date election returns from here and around the nation. Plus, a live house band. This Tuesday, the balance of Congress is at stake. So don't miss our special feature, a live Democrat-Republican Rock'em Sock'em Robot Thunderdome grudge match every hour. That's Tuesday, November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. on KBOO. And did I say live? Tune in and don't forget to vote.
Police officers then somehow got into a scuffle with him, knocked him down, dragged him around a bit from the looks of the autopsy, and then beat him by kicking him in the chest and kicking him in the head.
I was saying that sometimes police officers, that we get the impression that police officers, at least when they don the uniform, believe that they have a license to kill. And from the perspective of us in the community that are in the receiving end, we think they do. And it's a license they carry. And it's a license that gets reaffirmed every time they go to the grand jury because they never get indicted.
You know, there's one sort of justice which has to do with rules and laws and contracts, and I don't know anything about that stuff. But the other sort of justice has to do with feeling safe. Feeling safe with the police officers, our employees, the people we pay to keep the city safe, and feeling safe walking down the street. And right now, I don't know. I don't feel too safe. I know a lot of family members who think twice now before calling the police if they have a crisis at home.
Here was this gentle man who believed in the divine nature of justice and freedom, who happened to be mentally ill. And there were the brutes, deemed sane, who had the power to deny him his freedom and then take his life in the worst possible way without penalty. How can that be? I am lucky to have known James Chassie Jr., Jim. He was so very, very dear.
The question that comes to my mind as we come to this close is, what is enough enough? And enough is enough right now.
Welcome to Circle A Radio. On Friday, October 27th, a public memorial was held for James Chassie Jr., a Portland man who was beaten and killed by Portland police on September 17, 2006. On October 17th, a grand jury acquitted all three officers in the death of Chassie. This is Jason Renal with the Mental Health Association of Portland.
I know Jim for about 25 years. What we know is that Jim was a person who liked to wander and walk the streets, and he was doing that about 5:30 on September 17th. Now, a lot of the facts we know about the case, we need to sort of preface it by saying that these are facts reported to us now by police officers who are involved in the assault. Those facts haven't been verified by an outside independent source. So what we know is somehow the police officers encountered Jim, and Jim did not comply with what they instructed him to do. And I think that's safe to say, that he was spooked or walked off or did something non-compliant. The police officers then somehow got into a scuffle with him, knocked him down, dragged him around a bit from the looks of the autopsy, and then beat him by kicking him in the chest and kicking him in the head. Now, the law states clearly that a kick to the head is lethal force. These officers and the sheriff's deputy who were involved, there were three individuals, faced some jeopardy, certainly from the district attorney, if not from a civil suit. Chase was hogtied, which meant that his wrists were handcuffed behind his back, and his ankles were handcuffed, and his ankles and wrists were lashed together somehow. So he was in an arched position and left on the ground. We believe from witnesses that he was semi-conscious or unconscious for some duration. When the ambulance arrived, the ambulance driver or witnesses reported that he shouted out, "Don't leave me alone. Don't leave me alone," was quoted in the papers. Somehow it was decided that the ambulance should not take him to the hospital, but that instead a police squad car should take him to jail. Squad car took him to jail. Someone instructed the police officers, we're not sure who brought Jim in, and we're not sure how he was brought in, whether he was still shackled or not, that he was too badly injured to come to jail, that they instead should take him to the hospital. According to reports in the paper, the police officers then brought him back to the squad car, not an ambulance, and proceeded to try to drive him to Adventist Hospital, to a psychiatric ward, not an emergency room, and not the closest hospital. Adventist Hospital from the Portland jail is over 100 blocks, and it was rush hour on a weekday. At some point in the drive, police officers decided that Jim was dead. They pulled off, I think, Banfield and called for an ambulance. At that point, Jim was taken by ambulance to the coroner's office in Clackamas County. There is an autopsy report that was made public by the family. That's on our website, which is www.mentalhealthportland.org. It's rather grisly, and anyone who's interested in how organizations like the county come to decisions they do should take a look at it. It's very educational. What we also know about Jim is that he had schizophrenia, and he'd had it for a long time. It's an illness that makes communication confusing and difficult. Jim was a very quiet person, a very shy person, a person who did not like to be confronted, did not like to be noticed. To be shouted at by a police officer or to be commanded would, for Jim, it would be a normal response for him to run away, not to follow commands. It's an unusual finding that this would be described as an accident. There is a subset finding that the medical examiner can make, which is death by a law officer. It's not uncommon that people die at the hands of law officers, and so they do have a special definition for that. It's interesting that she would come to that conclusion, especially since all that she uses to come to her conclusion is the physical evidence of the body and the clothing, not the events leading up or leading away. According to the autopsy report, 26 ribs were cracked, splintered, or broken. He had contusions all over his body, been dragged through the over gravel. He had been kicked in the head. He had massive internal injuries, died within 20 minutes after the beating. An accident for most people would be falling off a ladder or sticking your finger in an electric plug, not being beaten at the hands of the police. I suppose that's some sort of strategy to say, listen, we want to do the right thing here. What do we do to make it right? And one thing the city can do is not defend itself ridiculously.
The following are the voices of friends and family of James Chassie Jr., recorded from the public memorial on October 27, 2006.
Linda Gerber, James Chassie's mother.
James was my firstborn son. The delivery was very difficult, almost a foretelling of the difficult life James would endure.
This is Jim Chassie Sr.
James was born enthusiastic. Like us all, he was excited to learn and to share. As a child, he loved and played with his grandparents, whom he outlived by several years. He got a little brother whom he loved and associated with as some sort of bonus to his preschool and neighborhood friends. He played and lived in the same neighborhood with these kids until moving in the fifth grade. At school and at OMSI in science-related courses, he excelled through the sixth grade. He camped, hiked, canoed, and fished in the local areas and in several other states until he was 14. Junior high was his nemesis, total frustration for him in a lot of areas. At about that time, he began to take the bus downtown and explore other avenues for intellectual stimulation. He began to make friends in Portland, and he began his own comic book writing and distribution, and to attend a Portland school.
Katie Kincaid.
I first met James Chassie, Jim, as he called himself, around 1976 or 7 during Portland's early punk scene. I hesitate to use that word punk, as it has unfortunately become a loaded and too narrowly defined term. I don't think I'm being overly sentimental to say that it was a familial atmosphere in which we encouraged one another to express ourselves through music, writing, and art. It was within this close-knit environment that not only myself, but many others knew and loved Jim. It was not simply because he was an imaginative artist, musician, and poet. There were others that could make the same claim. But because he was so sweet and so gentle and so genuine that he pulled at your heartstrings. And he was hilarious. Not the class clown, over-the-top kind of funny. He was much too shy and reserved for that, but extremely quick-witted. His observations always delivered with an impish smile. It was around that time, he must have been 14 or 15, when Jim was over at our house pretty much every day. We would just sit around and write, and he would draw cartoons in his notebook, which he carried with him always.
This is Mark Chassie, James Chassie Jr.'s brother.
I remember Jim taking me with him on TriMet to downtown Portland on rainy Saturdays to shop for the records at the old Crystal Ship, to the main library to peruse the latest magazines, and to armchair books and other places that are now long gone to look for the best comic books. When we were kids, Jim was often more popular than me, and he was, in my mind, the smart one. As he got a little older, he started to go off in a different direction. I didn't really understand him at the time, but as I think back now, he was probably trying to pursue what he really seemed to love, music.
This is Steve Doughton.
In 1978, I went to my first punk rock show at the Long Goodbye. The band The Wipers was playing. I'd never seen anything like it. For me, before that, to go see live music meant going to the Portland Coliseum to see Grand Funk or Black Sabbath and just sit and watch from a great distance. And here I had the opportunity to go to a little club and see music made by people my age. I didn't know anyone there. My world kind of changed there. And I was struck by how the musicians in the audience were basically the same. They seemed to be made up of people who were outcasts. And Jim Jim was there. At the time, punk meant kind of being very cool, and there was a kind of an aloof vibe to the whole scene, but not with Jim Jim. One day, Jim Jim just approached me, and I was amazed by his generosity of himself. He just wanted to talk to me and get to know me. We became friends right away.
This is Mike Lastra.
It was 1978. I found myself in the middle of a music revolution of sorts. Myself, my friends who had been in a band for years were like outsiders doing weird music for years all by ourselves. But suddenly in 78, we linked up with all these other bands here in town. It was like a spontaneous combustion, revolutionary moment. Who knows in time and space how these things work. But at some point, there was this young kid. I mean, I used to... He was the youngest amongst our group, and he was this, like, sweet kid, you know. He had this, that still childlike smile, if you can remember, that takes place, that innocent smile of, you know, bewilderment or just bliss that might happen, you know. He was like the darling of the scene. We invited him in. It was the cool thing. We thought, wow, this kid from, we didn't know, I mean, I didn't even know where he was from. It was just like he kind of took a liking to us because he had that same vision of an individual, an artist, you know, a free spirit, someone who saw the world a little different. And we were all about tolerance and come join the party, you know. And that's how I kind of got to know him. And he even joined our band on stage, you know, at least once. And again, you know, it was a thing between souls, creative souls of the sort, you know, being supportive, understanding what it's like to be isolated with your own vision, however it might have come to you. Even later, I recorded his band, the Possum Society, and I record a lot of music still, even to this day, and I was like, well, you know, I'm pretty good with artists of any sort. I just, you know, okay, whatever you want to do is still fine with me. And you know, you have these like beatnik lyrics, you know, like crazy cat, I'm a crazy cat. It was more like a cartoon kind of thing, and you know, I thought, huh, you know, that sounds cool.
This is Eva Lake, who read a speech written by Randy Moe, who was unable to attend.
When I met Jim Jim in 1978, my impression was of a bright, funny, creative young man. I had no idea he was only 14. He seemed far more aware than I was at that age. It was Jennifer LoBianco who introduced me to the first issue of the Oregon Organism, a photocopied punk rock fanzine Jim Jim produced. And here's a message from Jim Jim to the readers of issue number 3. Aha! Do I sense contributions? Thanks a lot, folks. You saved this magazine from an early death. Yes, you people sitting on your butts should contribute, too. I wanted to get some poetry for this thing, too. Contribute cartoons, also. If you can't draw, make a collage. Write an obscene letter. Just do anything. If you don't write poems, write one and send it in anyway. You may have ability. Oh my, I'm so dramatic. Just send in something. This magazine will last as long as I get contributions, comments, suggestions, weak bins, relevant works on psychosis, and other miscellany should be given to me. If you see me around somewhere. And it was very likely that you would see him around somewhere. He was, as he described himself in his first issue, a poet about town. Does anyone who went to those first punk rock shows in Portland not remember seeing Jim Jim?
The punk scene involved a relatively small but diverse community of eccentrics. Jim Jim found the freedom to be himself in this community.
Jim and his friends were way ahead of their time. If you ever go to the Experience Music Project in Seattle, there is a display showing the connection between the group of people Jim was around then and the grunge scene of the 90s. One of the people Jim was around back then, I heard long ago, wrote a song about Jim. I'd like to read the lyrics of this song because it now seems so prophetic about the rest of his life. It's called Alien Boy. Go and grab your gun. Got him on the run. Because he's an alien. They hurt what they don't understand. So you had to turn away. There's no other way. You're an alien. They hurt what they don't understand.
This is X.J. Elliott.
We shouldn't be here. We shouldn't have to be here. Jim Jim shouldn't be dead, but he is. I met Jim Jim soon after I moved to Portland in 1978. He was 14 years old and already a fixture in the new music scene. I would see him at punk shows, at Renaissance Records, or on the street hanging out. He would visit me in my tiny apartment high atop the Anthrax downtown. We'd listen to albums or 45s of punk, reggae, and industrial music. Sometimes he and I would ride around in the back of Bill Machowski's van with the likes of Greg Sage, Mr. Mike Shirley, Dudley Clute, or any number of other guys. He was a total fan of the local punk scene, loving especially the Wipers, Neo Boys, and the Fix, as I recall. He would always be found front and center at all ages shows, and those he could not get into because he was too young, he would just hang out outside and make the scene. Jim Jim was sweet, funny, and sensitive, a real bundle of energy. He was a dapper little anarchist, and he was as involved and engaged as any of us. He was a male muse for me back then. He inspired a character in the novel I was writing at the time, The Revolution of the Irrational, as well as a play idea I had called The Teeth of Love. He appears throughout my journal, Memories of the Cruelty. He inspired me and he encouraged me, and I was not alone. He was the inspiration for Greg Sage and the Wipers' Alien Boy and Neo Boy's Nothing to Fear.
Again, Steve Downton.
At one point he asked me to join a band, and I didn't know how to play an instrument, and he said, that's okay. And luckily, two other members of the band knew how to play. It were Mr. Mike and John, who handled the rhythm section. Through that band, I made some lifelong friends that are a direct result of my friendship with Jim Jim. He changed his name at that point. He was Jay. Jim Jim was now a curse. He was becoming paranoid, and it was becoming more and more obvious. At one point, during a practice, he made it clear that there was something wrong with the jam session, and it had to do with the rest of us. So he insisted on us sitting and listening to him. And we told him he was crazy. And we disbanded right then. He did have a mental illness. And when we called him crazy, we really meant that he was being obnoxious and eccentric. But that's not what was going on. And so I guess, you know, this group of people who felt misunderstood, and that unified us, my misunderstandings of Jim Jim separated me from him to a large degree.
This is Jason Renaud.
We were sitting out in front of the Central Library in about 1981. We both spent a lot of time at the library. And we were just doing the thing we do, which is smoke and read books and hang out. And I noticed that Jim is being really quiet, and he looks at me and he says, "I can't talk to you. Don't talk to me." I said, because I know he's got the spark of Dionysus inside of him, right? It's a dangerous god. He says, "Don't talk to me." "Why? What?" And he says, he's got his fist. "If I open my hand, the world will come to an end." And that's a powerful thing. It's a heavy weight to hold, to carry. And he was, all of his attention was on that hand, saying, "If I have to keep, the world is on my shoulders." And he was very brave. People don't survive with his illness unless they're brave.
X.J. Eliot.
In May of 1979, Jim was sent away to Damish State Mental Hospital, and the punk community was beside itself. With nothing to be done, we worried and waited for days. Imagine a lively 15-year-old boy in a state mental institution. I remember making and wearing a free Jim badge, and graffiti might have been involved as well. We were so happy when he heard that he was out, and ecstatic when he was finally back amongst us. He never said what all happened inside, but he became pretty paranoid after that. He worried that he'd be sent away again, and we vowed not to let that happen. Sometime in late 79 or 80, he became even more nervous. I saw less of him around, but would hear stories that made me worry for him. He had become moody, erratic, and obsessive. He had changed his name from Jim to Jay to JXing Star or something. He was hit by a TriMet bus back then, and I heard he was on crutches and a cane. The last substantial conversation I had with him was in late 1982 or early 1983. He came into Friction, the gallery I was a collective member of, and asked if he could talk with me. I told him, of course, and we began to have a tentative chat about what was up. Then he began to unveil his secret, his mystery. He told me that he was the reincarnation of Joan of Arc and that he was still being pursued by demons and witches from lifetimes ago. He said that they wanted to martyr him again. He also told me he wanted people to call him Joan. Now, all of this might sound crazy, of course, especially now in context and with clearer hindsight, but at the time, I just wanted him to feel safe and cared about. I didn't want him to feel such fear, worry, or torment. We talked for a while, and he left seeming calmer than he had entered, and I hoped that he would be okay. After that, I would only occasionally see him on the street doing his own form of gender fuck, his own style of cross-dressing. He never seemed to notice me, and I never shouted or waved or ran over to him either.
This is Jim Chassie Sr.
From about age 16, he had definite psychological issues. These continued and fluctuated. His illness was far beyond anything I knew. Occasionally, we would be hit with the differences in the facets of his mind. He did not complain, and what we did together was always with the spirit of doing something good. Most activities, like hiking or touring a particular area neighborhood, were very simple and seemed relaxing in a family way for James. An avid supporter of the hubbub of Portland, he liked especially to be walking in the South Park blocks, perusing at Powell's, his church, and whatever book he was reading. In all, he could function as a very young person whose eloquence was miserably limited by his psychosis. His underlying kindness and love for others showed through it all, a model of what our Lord asked of us. He was always kind and uncomplaining to us. He brought no tales of mistreatment, life complaints, how tough it was to deal with his illness, or any kind of negative thought about his life or people around him or his living quarters. In the end, our prayer for us all is to remember we are the persons who can spread the tolerance for diverse individuals living under frustrating circumstances. We are the ones who can spread peace and love to those who do not know the meaning.
Again, Steve Downton.
I was in Powell's Books in 1998, and this person approached me and said, "Hi, I'm Jim. I used to be called Jay or Jim Jim. We were friends. We were in a band together. Do you remember me?" And I looked at him, and he had a big beard, and but sure enough, it was Jim Jim. He was still walking with a cane from that limp that he had from when he was hit by a TriMet bus in the early 80s. And I saw his face, and he asked me if I'd like to sit down. So we sat down in Ann Hughes Coffee Shop and had tea and cookies. And he explained to me that he was on new medications. He asked me if I remember that he was afraid of werewolves. And I told him I remembered that. And he asked me if I remembered that he thought I was a werewolf. And I said, no. And he said he didn't believe in them anymore. And he wasn't afraid of them anymore. And that the medication was really helping him. And he was living in a halfway house. And he asked for my address. And I gave it to him. And a couple of months later, when I was back in New York, I received this letter from him. It's from 1998, and it's short. It just says, "Dear Steve, this is a letter from Jay of Possum Society. I thought I'd try to explain who I am. I listen to jazz music on the radio sometimes. I like Mad Magazine. This month I think that the cover was about a movie called Armageddon or something like that. From Jay Chassie. I've moved. My new address is," and he gives it. "Please write to James J. Chassie. I'm called James where I stay. I never did write him back."
This is Katie Kincaid.
The last time I heard from Jim Jim was in the late 90s when he called and asked if I would be a soldier in his army of angels. And I answered, "Well, I suppose it would depend on what you were fighting for, Jim Jim." And then he heaved a deep sigh and answered in a very patient voice, "Justice and freedom." As if these were the only things worth fighting for, and my question had been a most ridiculous one. Since his death, I can't help but think about this last conversation. Here was this gentle man who believed in the divine nature of justice and freedom, who happened to be mentally ill. And there were the brutes, deemed sane, who had the power to deny him his freedom and then take his life in the worst possible way without penalty. I so wish we could all see Jim Jim's angels. I am lucky to have known James Chassie Jr., Jim Jim. He was so very, very dear.
Again, X.J. Elliott.
In mid-September of this year, a good friend of mine died, and I was in the depths of that when I heard the news of how two Portland police and one Multnomah County Sheriff's deputy had killed another mentally ill person on the streets of the Pearl. I thought, oh no, not another one. Little men always destroy what they cannot fathom. In the nearly three decades that I have lived in this town, the police have too often killed people with mental or social problems, and they've gotten away with it. They've gotten away with murder. But this story sounded even more extreme. The brutality, the senselessness, the complete and utter disregard for human life. Surely the police could not get away with such a blatant public murder this time. But of course, we all know the unbelievable verdict by now. When I first realized that the person the three officers had killed was Jim Jim, I was flattened. I was overwhelmed by the pure immensity of it all. Another part of my heart was broken. Oh, 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 Jim. I went to my old journals and reread his part in my life. I immediately started writing an epic poem about my old friend, my old comrade. I was amazed that the press picked up on the murder of Jim Jim. Of course, if there hadn't been someone with a cell phone taking photos, who knows how the story might have come out. With the conflicting facts of the case and the police machine closing ranks, I think they thought they could really get away with it again, but I don't see how they can. Kyle Nice, Chris Humphreys, and Brett Burton must be fired. No one feels safer with them on the loose. We're angered and disgusted by such flagrant abuses by the police, and we feel that all the rhetoric put up is a diversion and really misses the point. As you can see, it's easy to get volatile about this, because Jim Jim deserved better. He did not deserve to be murdered by the police for pissing in the street. No one does. He did not deserve to be murdered for being crazy. No one does. And he did not deserve to be tortured to death for being different. No one does. And that is part of the horror of Jim Jim's murder. It could be anyone. It could be any of us. It could be me. It could be you. All for being different. Back in the day, the so-called punk scene was made up of all kinds of different people. Most could not or would not fit into more conformist roles. We were the weirdos, lunatics, and cast-offs, called crazy, punks, and queers. We were marginalized, ostracized, and harassed. We were a small and ever-changing bunch, creatively making our own world of noise and vision. We created bonds that transcend time and place. And we are still among you. We are still fighting that cultural revolution. Remember Jim Jim, honor Jim Jim, and free Jim Jim.
Linda Gerber.
He had a goal that he wanted to be a volunteer counselor for the mentally ill one day. Jim never felt sorry for himself, although life didn't treat him fairly. That such a sweet, gentle man should die so violently and senselessly is a great tragedy, not just for Jim, but for all who mourn him. James, I will always miss you and love you, my precious son.
This is Mark Chassie.
I think the rest of us can only imagine what courage it must have taken every day to live in his shoes with all that we have compared to him. Much to Jim's credit, he never showed bitterness or anger towards his lot in life. For the past several years, he enjoyed some of the same things he had since he was very young, including his love of music, comic books, and walking. He was religious and spoke frequently about his beliefs. He enjoyed being with us, his family. He was always very excited about everything related to Christmas and Halloween. He was always kind, gentle, and compassionate. Jim had a difficult life, and its end was horribly, horribly unjust. There was for all of us, however, undoubtedly significant meaning in Jim's life. What is really the difference between any of us and him or so many others among us who are less fortunate? In Jim's memory, renew your ability to treat others as you would wish to be treated. We are all God's children.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Tonight we are focusing on James Chassie Jr., a man killed by one officer of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department and two members of the Portland Police.
This is Martin Gonzalez, leader in the Movement for Justice for Jose Mejia Pope.
I want to express my condolences to the family, to the friends, and to all of you that, who are here present. I did not know James Chassie. I got to know him tonight, like perhaps some of you did tonight, and discover some things that I had in common with him. Love for poetry, love for reading comic books, of course. As important, a love for justice and freedom. Yesterday I was sitting in a bus station in Yucatan, in the state of Yucatan in Mexico. I was listening to men that were speaking Maya, and I was reminded of another death, of another person that was killed by Portland Police Department,
on April 1st of 2001. His name was Jose Santos Victor Mejia Pot. Some of you might recall it. It's a man that was on the way to work, was boarding the bus, was short 20 cents, was taken off the bus and beaten by the Portland police, taken into custody, later released, then found in the street by another police person that took him to a hospital where he was misdiagnosed as mentally ill and placed in Gateway Hospital. A couple of days later, he tried to get, you know, leave since, you know, he wanted to go home. Tried unsuccessfully two times. The second time that he tried it, the Portland police was called once again, and he was killed, shot and killed by the Portland police, once in the head, once in the chest. For many of us, that revealed a failure of an entire system that was not able to deal with people that were different. I think we heard many testimonies here today about that, about the need for change and the need to love one another, to embrace one another, and to lift up, I think, the life of people, the human dignity, I think, of all of us. I want to call on you to think about that, you know, not to forget that these things has, you know, has happened before. Today I read the paper and found two articles related to James Chassie's death. And it struck me that there are certain things that are said that if we do not call attention to or are somewhat outraged by them, things will continue to happen. And it spoke, you know, of one of the police persons that was interviewed, because they were asking for comment, because, you know, this police officer had a history before of police brutality, and, you know, they couldn't be contacted because they were traumatized by the whole experience. And I recall back, you know, years back also, you know, one of the officers that killed Jose Santos Mejia Pot later on went and participated in the killing of another young man named Eddie Hamsbath. And yet, you know, the traumatic experience that that person had, you know, two or three years earlier didn't help them understand that those things need to not happen again. So I think that we need to call attention to those things and say, look, there is a need for change. Because many deaths have happened since Santos Mejia Pot. Some of them also people that were labeled or they were mentally ill. I was saying that sometimes police officers, that we get the impression that police officers, some police officers, at least when they don the uniform, believe that they have a license to kill. And from the perspective of us in the community that are in the receiving end, we think they do. And it's a license they carry. And it's a license that gets reaffirmed every time they go to the grand jury because they never get indicted. So their system that needs to change, not only in regards to the training that was gained from the Mejia Pot, the procedures that are in place that justify these killings needs to change. The procedures that say that if a police officer says they fear for their life, that gives them the ability to justify, you know, the taking of a life needs to change. The other thing I want to leave you with is I was very active in the movement of El Salvador, and every time one of our people fell in the struggle, you know, for justice and freedom, there was a song that we did, because many times we did not know the person, we did not know their face, we did not know their names. And this is what the song says. Please know that I only die if you do not continue to struggle. Because each person that dies in the struggle, as in the case of James Chassie Jr. today, for justice and freedom, will die if you do not continue to struggle. Let's continue to struggle for justice and freedom. Thank you.
This is Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Tell us a little bit about what you know about the complaints about excessive force that those officers had already, and some of their history on the force.
With Kyle Nice, Officer Nice, we actually followed the earlier case where was involved in a shooting where a man
allegedly had threatened some people, and they came into his house, and he was, according to his story, sitting on the couch, and there was a shotgun next to him, but he had basically never used it, or even he didn't pick it up or raise it at them, but they shot him anyway, and he was left-handed. They shot him in his left arm, and he was completely unable to work after that. And this was the previous incident that we know of with Sergeant Nice. And with Officer Humphreys, all we know is what we, you know, what we've been reading in the papers is about this case with a teenager that was settled. There was another person who was wanted for criminal activity, and his friend was driving a truck that had left the scene, and the police pulled over the friend in the truck and assumed he was the guy they were looking for. Officer Humphreys beat him pretty mercilessly. It's multiple baton blows. The city ended up paying him $30,000 plus another $60,000 in attorney's fees for that. Officer Humphreys, as well, is at the top of the list of officers who use force, and particularly what I find interesting, he's number one for using hand strikes and blows against people. That's one of the questions about the Chassis case, is the kicking and punching and hitting and kicking in the head and the chest, which contributed to his death.
What is the official definition of excessive force?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how you define excessive force. What I know is that what the Oregon state law says is that officers may only use a reasonable amount of force to achieve their objective. Excessive force would be anything that wouldn't be reasonable in a certain circumstance. Unfortunately, most of the time the court interprets reasonable as what the officer at the time in the officer's mind frame believes is reasonable. And that goes to not only less than lethal force, but lethal force as well. So that if the officer reasonably believes that his life is in danger, that's what allows them to use deadly force. The thing that concerned me the most about Chassis case that we wrote to the district attorney before the grand jury came out with its unsurprising but disappointing finding, not indicting the officers, was that by punching Mr. Chassis in the face and kicking him in the head, and I would add using a taser against him, but anybody using a taser should know that it's called a less lethal weapon, not a non-lethal weapon. All those things, kicking somebody, punching somebody in the head, using a taser, are essentially uses of deadly force, because you know that when you do that, it could kill somebody. So for the coroner to say this case was an accident because the officers didn't intend to kill Mr. Chassis, that is a complete falsification, because they used several forms of force that could be considered deadly force. And at that point, they had basically made a decision that if they killed this guy, so be it.
Have there been any cases within the last 10 years where an officer who has killed a civilian, have there been any cases where the officers have been held accountable for their murder?
Well, let's be clear about this. When somebody files a lawsuit against an officer for something that they did in the course of their duty, it's not the officer who's being held accountable, it's the city that's paying. This money does not come out of the officer's pockets. Fortunately, for what it's worth, our somewhat weak independent police review board added a provision that whenever somebody files a lawsuit against an officer, that they will treat it as though it was a complaint that came in. Therefore, there is a possibility of an officer being held accountable when a lawsuit's filed. But otherwise, even if a jury finds the officer used excessive force, that doesn't necessarily go on their record. That's the way it is. In the Jose Mejia case, there was a settlement with the family. What that settlement came to, and this was a mixed bag, but it's a good thing when police agree to change something in their training. The Jose Mejia case, they got an agreement to do 2 hours of crisis intervention team training for every officer. Now, that's a 40-hour training, so 2 hours is not going to get them what they need to help de-escalate situations where somebody is or maybe in a mental health crisis. But the other part of it was getting, I think, 100 new tasers. And if the family had asked me, I would have said, I'm sure it's better to taser somebody than it is to shoot them. But tasers have killed a lot of people. A lot of people who have mental health issues, particularly, and apparently are not necessarily effective on people with epilepsy, which Mr. Mejia actually was suffering from epilepsy. So that case was settled in favor of the family, and there was a man named Damon Lowry, 1999. He was at a friend's house, and he was high on some drugs, and the police came to the door, and he jumped out the window. And while he was lying there bleeding, the police shot him with beanbags and emptied several cans of pepper spray into his open neck wound and beat on him with batons. And he finally got up and ran away, and they stood on him. One officer stood on him for 2 minutes, and when the ambulance came, he pretty much had expired. And his family ended up getting a settlement from the city of $600,000. Dickie Dow's family also ended up with a settlement of $400,000 or thereabouts. And the interesting thing in that case is that the pepper spray company also got dinged for $10,000. What happened with Dickie Dow was almost the exact same thing that happened with James Chassie. It's a schizophrenic man who ended up having being piled on by the police, and they pepper sprayed him, and then he ended up dying the next day from all of his injuries from the police action. Again, there were no specific policy changes made in that settlement. Kendra James's case, unfortunately, the family did not prevail in that case, which was very surprising to everybody involved. It was pretty clear that the officer in that case had made up some of the statements he made to investigators. And the James Perez case, KBOO listeners should know, is going to trial. This lawsuit is coming to trial November 13th, or at least is scheduled to, at the Pioneer Courthouse downtown at 9 a.m. That's something that we should watch. And what's happening now with the Chassie case and what's going to happen in the future is that there's an internal investigation that automatically happens. The family, as far as I know, has not filed the lawsuit yet. They have engaged an attorney who has been involved in every step of the way, which is a great advantage over some of the other families who had this unfortunate thing happen. As you can see from the outcome of the grand jury, it didn't necessarily make that big of a difference, but it's a good thing because now they have a lot more information up front than they would get if they were starting from scratch 6 months or a year down the line, which is often when people end up filing their lawsuits. So this internal investigation is being done, apparently, with the cooperation of the Independent Police Review Division, partly because witnesses filed complaints with them, just having seen the beating. There's a difference of opinion, I would say, between our group and the auditor's office. The auditor oversees the IPR, about whether or not the citizens who sit on the review board that's part of the IPR can review cases if there is a death involved. The ordinance does not actually prohibit them from doing that. The auditor did not want citizens looking at death cases at all and created a part of the ordinance that allows an outside group, which right now it's the Police Assessment Resource Center, to review all shooting cases that the Portland Police shooting and death in custody cases. And in fact, several of their recommendations have made the process better after a shooting like this. In any case, if these complaints are found not sustained, if the IPR internal investigation doesn't see that there was any kind of excessive force, the citizens who file those complaints, in theory, should be able to file an appeal to the review board. The director's already made a statement that she's not going to let that happen. Meanwhile, so she's doing this investigation with the Internal Affairs Division, who are taking information that the homicide detectives put together for the criminal case. Then they're taking independent statements from the officers and all the witnesses. And they're going to hand this case with all this information over to what's called the Use of Force Review Board to determine whether the officers were within Bureau policy or not. Now, I don't know how this complicates matters that there's a sheriff's deputy involved. And we've been talking to the auditor for years now about the fact that when there's a high-speed chase, it's determined who decides when to call off the chase or not by an agreement, an inter-bureau agreement. But when there's deadly force involved, it's not clear who says, wait, don't kick this guy in the head, or don't use your taser, or don't pull your gun. So the Use of Force Review Board will meet in secret and come out with an in-policy or out-of-policy decision, and it's not 100% clear how much of that we're ever going to hear because that becomes an officer's personnel record. I'm going to guess that the chief will make the decision to make the outcome public because this is a very high-profile case. In theory, every single case where an officer uses enough force where somebody goes to the hospital goes to this board. And so there's dozens and dozens and dozens of these cases that we don't hear anything about.
This is Dr. T. Allen Bethel of the Maranatha Church of God and president of the Albina Ministerial Alliance.
We extend our condolences to the Chassie family. The question that comes to my mind as we come to this close is, when is enough enough? And enough is enough right now. Some months ago, when the district attorneys around the state, along with some of the police chiefs and captains of many of the departments, began to have a discussion about what was happening in the city of Portland because of the police brutality of the officer-involved shootings, many of them remarked, it is a Portland problem. Well, we've lived to see in the last few years, in the last few months, that it is a problem that not only touches Portland, it touches all of our communities that are around us. There is a phrase in a song in which we sing many a times during the month of February and that national anthem, just one short phrase that begins to say, lest we forget. I don't want you to forget when you leave tonight And many tears tonight and many tears of the last few months and years have watered the soil in this city. I do not want you to forget that there have been many feet that have trod along the path, still walks on that path for justice. I do not want you to forget that the voices that have been lifted to sing that chorus, yes, that we shall overcome, is one that your voice needs to join. We need to say not only to our mayor and to our police chief and to our sheriff, but to all of them, and particularly we leave out the police union, that we will not stand for this anymore, because enough is enough.
This is Becky Child from the Mental Health Association of Oregon.
I'm sorry that we have to meet in this manner. From the conference, we have an open petition to the mayor, the police chief, and the sheriff of Multnomah County. And I'll read it. Dear Mayor Potter, Chief Sizer, and Sheriff Giusto, James Chassie's death at the hands of Portland law officers has had tremendous impact to the community of persons with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities and our friends and families. His killing undermines the trust we must have with our city, our police, and our deputies. Many people with psychiatric disabilities have had fearful, dangerous, or humiliating experiences with law officers. The law officers' killings of James Chassie makes it even less likely that we or our family members, friends, employers, neighbors, or even our caregivers will call the police in time of need. We, the undersigned, ask you to publicly pledge the following within 14 days. Crisis intervention team training for all law officers who have contact with the public within 6 months. That includes training for people who have firsthand experience with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities. A dialogue with the three of you so that you can hear firsthand our community's experiences with law officers. Sensitivity training on interacting with individuals with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities for all law officers within 6 months. Every single officer to spend 8 hours with individuals with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities who are willing to spend a day with a police officer in order that they can see us as human beings who work, play, laugh, are human, and have difficult times, etc. Police Academy trainings to include a minimum of 16 hours of interacting with individuals with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities. These trainings must be conducted by individuals who self-identify as currently or previously having psychiatric or cognitive disabilities. If you want to have trainings by mental health professionals, we expect that to be in addition to the above minimum that we are requesting. There have been too many needless deaths of individuals with psychiatric disabilities and cognitive disabilities at the hands of law officers in Portland. We are a valuable part of our city. Your pledge will show that you respect and value our community. Well, I did not have the pleasure and honor of knowing James. I have a poem that I think, based on what I've heard tonight, that he would agree with. It's by Norman A. Kunk. Throughout history, people with physical and mental disabilities have been abandoned at birth, banished from society, used as court jesters, drowned and burned during the Inquisition, gassed in Nazi Germany, and still continue to be segregated, institutionalized, tortured in the name of behavior management, abused, raped, euthanized, and murdered. Now, for the first time, people with disabilities are taking their rightful place as fully contributing citizens. The danger is that we will respond with remediation and benevolence rather than equity and respect. And so we offer you a credo for support. Recognize that my disability is an attribute. Do not see my disability as a deficit. It is you who see me as deviant and helpless. Do not try to fix me because I am not broken. Support me. I can make my contribution to the community in my own way. Do not see me as your client. I am your fellow citizen. See me as your neighbor. Remember, none of us can be self-sufficient. Do not try to modify my behavior. Be still and listen. What you define as inappropriate may be my attempt to communicate with you in the only way I can. Do not try to change me. You have no right. Help me learn what I want to know. Do not hide your uncertainty behind professional distance. Be a person who listens and does not take my struggle away from me by trying to make it all better. Do not use theories and strategies on me. Be with me. And when we struggle with each other, Let that give rise to self-reflection. Do not try to control me. I have a right to my power as a person. What you call noncompliance or manipulation may actually be the only way I can exert some control in my life. Do not teach me to be obedient, submissive, and polite. I need to feel entitled to say no if I am to protect myself. Do not be charitable towards me. The last thing this world needs is another Jerry Lewis. Be my ally as I fight against those who exploit me for their own gratification. Do not try to be my friend. I deserve more than that. Get to know me. We may become friends. Ask me if I need your help. Let me show you how you can best assist me. Do not admire me. A desire to live a full life does not warrant adoration. Respect me, for respect presumes equity. Do not tell, correct, and lead. Listen, support, and follow. Do not work on me. Work with me.
For joining us on Circle A Radio.
Tonight, people all over Mexico and Central America are celebrating Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, paying tribute to loved ones who have passed on.
Tonight we remember James Chassie and those before him, other victims of police brutality. We honor his struggle for truth, justice, and his gentle spirit. We also remember Kendra James, Jose Mejia Put, Damon Lowry, Dickie Dow, James Jahar Perez, Fahud Kadi, and many others. We also honor those who have recently lost their lives in Oaxaca, Mexico, due to state repression.
For those who are interested in participating in the Day of the Dead celebrations, VOS, Workers' Rights Education Project, is hosting an event this Friday, November 3rd, at 7 p.m. at the dining hall of St. Francis Church. St. Francis Church is located at 330 Southeast 11th Avenue. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to bring their favorite food to share and a picture of a dead relative or friend.
Also, on Thursday, November 2nd, the Bolivarian Media Exchange will be hosting a screening of the film The Agronomist, an inspiring documentary about Haitian journalist Jean Dominique, who was assassinated in May of 2000. This event begins at 7 p.m., and will take place at Liberty Hall, which is located at 311 North Ivy Street. There will also be a Day of the Dead altar at this event as we pay tribute to those who have given their lives in the struggle for social justice.
Circle A Radio airs twice a month here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We'd like to thank Jason Renault, Icky, and Molly McKernan.
Thanks for listening.